Let me express my appreciation to all of you for letting me be a part of this. It's always fun to come home, you know. I've been here so many times, between Camp Manitou and all the programs we've done in public. Steve May sitting over here, he and I have done, I don't know how many, 25 or so programs together at one time or another. And so it's just great. And I could tell you Walt Straker's stories till they came out, you know. We went to Bozeman, Montana. He was there. I was there for one whole summer. He's the preacher. I never heard him preach once. He's a master at getting somebody else to preach. But he was doing such a great job. That congregation grew like crazy during that time, and it was great to be with him. It's great to be here. I've been asked to do one of my regular programs today because we've been talking about some specialized things. And I thought I would try to point out to you some of the approaches that we take as we go along here. When I'm talking to atheists, which is what I normally do, most of our programs are on neutral ground. I don't speak in churches very much because we're trying to reach out. And I start out by saying, do you believe you exist? I think that's an important question. Because if they say no, my response is always, well, you got bigger problems than I want to deal with. Because there are people who are so determined to deny God that they will deny their own existence. And what I'm talking is evidence. I've mentioned Anthony Flew to you a number of times. You have to go where the evidence leads. And it's kind of interesting to watch atheists try to deny Flew. You know, he was the leading atheist for so many years. He was their champion. And now, his last book is There Is a God. And they're trying to say, well, he was just getting old and senile. And I'll say, okay, then explain chapter 3 to me, will you please? That's not the wording of an old senile man. That's a man hitting on all cylinders. Man that's brilliant. And who goes where the evidence leads. So what we try to do is to talk about the fact that there is a logical structure to the question of the existence of God. If you look at reality, if you deal with where the evidence leads, assuming you exist, there are certain choices to be made. Did the creation have a beginning? Or is the atheist assertion over the years that it's eternal valid scientifically? See, my arguments come from science. I came to believe in God because of science. If you're not familiar with me, you don't know anything about my conversion, we still have a few copies of Why I Left Atheism on the handout table over there. And help yourself. But I think it's important to understand that that's a scientific question. The Bible makes it clear that there was a beginning. Makes it clear that God existed before the beginning. That the very nature of God is similar to what science has arrived at in recent years. All scientific discussions now are talking about dimensions, about the fact that there are entities that exist outside of time and space. And that's interesting because back when I was an atheist, I used to argue that nothing could be outside of time and space. But science has destroyed anybody attempting to say something like that. Was it caused or was it not caused? That's an easy question to deal with. You have to deny all known science to maintain it was not caused. And so the last step, which is what we're going to do this afternoon, is to say, okay, then what was the cause? In atheist philosophy classes, and this is Richard Dawkins, required reading in most freshman college philosophy classes, the statement is that we are not the product of anything with intelligence. The universe has the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Is that what the evidence shows? Can we logically and reasonably believe that assumption, that philosophical assumption, about the creation? And as I've tried to say to you, that starts early because in the eighth grade our kids are hit with this. So what we want to do is talk about design this afternoon. And I think this is a great closing lesson, because what this means is that as you leave here today and however you drive out of here, maybe you'll take a look, a little more of a look at the beauty around you. I don't know how many can drive in Ontario and not be impressed with the beauty and the wisdom and the design all around us. You know, that's one of the reasons I love to come up here. And I've got film, probably 50,000 pictures I've taken of rocks. My wife thinks I'm nuts, you know. What are you taking a picture of that rock for? Well, that's a Jasper conglomerate. It came from Bruce Mines. Really? So? And I say, why do you do that? It's beauty. It's speaking to me of the creation around us. But there are examples. One of those examples is intuitive design. Now this is not any high-powered discussion here. This is just look at the evidence and think. This is one kind of design. For a lot of us, that's all we need. I don't know how anybody watches a human baby be born and not be impressed with design. For that matter, how did you look at your first child and think that was some kind of happy accident? You know? But the fact of the matter is that there are other kinds of design. There's architectural design. There's irreducible complexity. And then there's the principle known as the soft anthropic principle. And we'll talk about those things a little bit this afternoon. So let's talk about some of these design features, like architectural design. You ever notice what a beehive looks like? Incredibly beautiful. But also the geometry is interesting. You'll notice that the hive is made of six-sided structures, hexagons, and they fit together very precisely. One of the things you may not realize is that there is incredible engineering wisdom involved in this. One of my challenges to you this week has been, do you perceive God as a magician or as an engineer? This is not the work of a magician. They're not just a magic wand waved here. There's an intelligent purpose designed behind this. Because you see, when you put a weight in a hexagon, it is distributed evenly around the hexagon. The result of that is that when they're building supersonic aircraft, they use hexagons set side to side, top to bottom. They're not only the strongest structure possible, but they also are the most compact. Now you say, well, wait a minute, I thought a triangle was the most compact. Well, a triangle's fine if you're dealing with open spacing. But the problem is, as you look at a weight inside a triangle, all of the weight is on one side, and that tends to bend that side. So if you're dealing with structures like an airplane wing or a beehive, you don't want a triangle. Triangles to be very compact, but if you put something like honey in a triangle, all the weight's on the bottom. And I love to watch evolutionists trying to deal with this. You know, you say, are you going to talk about trial and error? Okay, let's suppose the first bee decided that he was not going to make his honeycomb out of a hexagon. He didn't know about that. He was going to use a square or a rectangle or a triangle. What happens? It collapses because all of the weight is on the base. Scratch one bee. Who's going to do the next experiment? It's pretty difficult to come up with a trial and error mentality in explaining that kind of structure. Now, I'm not going to give you any big heavy discussion here. I'm just saying this is intuitive. Look at it. Think. How can you reasonably come to an understanding of why this structure in the earliest honeycombs turns out to be six-sided? Now, I have atheist friends who say, well, columnar basalt is six-sided. That's an accident. No, that's another design feature. Different structure. Another one of my favorite examples, not dealing just with honeycomb, and the way that the structure can be designed and put into use by man in things like airplanes and supersonic aircraft. But one of my favorite illustrations, and if you've been with me, you've heard me use this, I think it's a classic, is the Fibonacci ratio. Fibonacci was a mathematician in the 13th century. He came up with a sequence of numbers. Mathematicians love to talk about Fibonacci sequences. It's very simple, really. You just take one number and add it to the next number to get the next number. So 13 plus 21 is 34, 21 plus 34 is 55, and so forth. That's called a Fibonacci sequence. Well, that's interesting. Mathematicians get excited about that. Mathematicians are kind of strange people, though, so I don't know if that would convince anybody. My degree's in math, okay? So let's talk about a different kind of structure. Let's talk about how architects use this. Because if you take a basic course in architecture, one of the things you'll learn in Architecture 101 is that the Fibonacci sequence is essential for building aesthetically appealing structures. So if you make a rectangle into a building, like 13 by 8 feet, people are going to say, no, this is a neat building. This is cool. I like this building. But if you made it 13 by 10, they'd say, who designed this? And it's kind of interesting that there are other things that happen with this, because you can cut squares out of a Fibonacci rectangle, and what is left is another Fibonacci rectangle. See, if you had the building that was 21 feet long and you cut a 13 by 13 square off of what's left is 8 this way and 13 this way, and 8 by 13 is another Fibonacci ratio. So you cut a square off the rectangle, you have another Fibonacci rectangle. Isn't that amazing? And then you start connecting corners. If you connect the corners of those squares, what you end up with is called a Fibonacci spiral. And the Fibonacci spiral has been enormously interesting to architectural students, because they have learned if you're going to make a staircase, for example, you make it out of a Fibonacci spiral. The decorative structures on buildings would be Fibonacci spirals. But you know what? Humans like the Fibonacci spiral because it's aesthetically appealing. But apparently, God likes it too, because he uses it over and over and over in just about everything he does. If you take a look at a spiral galaxy, the arms of the galaxy are wound in a Fibonacci spiral. If you take that spiral and put it on that galaxy, it will fit perfectly. You take a look at the curl of a wave. It curls with the Fibonacci spiral. You take that spiral, put it on there, it fits perfectly. You watch water go down the drain. Counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere. Clockwise in the southern. You know what the first thing I did was when I got to Australia? Yeah. Filled the sink, pulled the plug. Sure enough, water went down the wrong way. Well, actually, that force is so weak that that won't always work. I had a field day in Ecuador when they were trying to show this at the National Exhibit Center in Ecuador. They had it faked. They had the tubs, a tub north of the equator and a tub five feet away south of the equator. Had them both filled with water, and they pulled the plug and the water went down opposite directions. So I had the girl switch the tubs. Didn't work. Why? Well, they had made the tubs to go down the way they wanted it to, and you couldn't change the position of the tubs, and she didn't know it. I got escorted out of there. But anyway, the point is, it's interesting to realize that however the water goes down the drain, it goes down the drain in a Fibonacci spiral. You say, all right, you got a gravitational something rather. No. Because in weightlessness, subatomic particles curl with Fibonacci spirals. In cases where water buoyancy counteracts gravity, like seashells, they still curl with a Fibonacci spiral. And that's true of ancient fossils as well as the spirals in your garden. A spider web curls with a Fibonacci spiral. We see the Fibonacci spiral in the limbic structure of the human brain. I gave this lecture at MIT a couple of years ago. There was a surgeon who attended. He said, did you know that there are 13 Fibonacci spirals in the human brain? I said, no, I didn't know that. Tell me more. He said, I'll send you a paper on it. So I get this 426-page paper, and I don't understand the paper, but I can see the spiral he's talking about. We see the Fibonacci spiral in the horns of every animal that you can conceive of, both living and extinct. We see the Fibonacci spiral in the curl of the teeth of a groundhog. We see the Fibonacci spiral in the curl of the teeth of a grizzly bear. We see the Fibonacci spiral in the beak of every bird that you can think of. We see it in the tail of a chameleon. We see it in the tubers of pumpkins and potatoes and tomatoes. We see it in the structures involved in the petals of a magnolia, or in sunflower seeds, or in a pine cone. We see the Fibonacci spiral in the fingerprint. Are you picking up a pattern here? Now, there is no reason for this. There is absolutely no reason for this. The Fibonacci spiral is not stronger than other geometric shapes. We already talked about the hexagon. It has no particular strength value. And give me an evolutionary explanation here. How are you more fit because your fingerprint curls in the Fibonacci spiral than it would go if it didn't? What's natural selection going to work on? There is no reason for this thing to be the way it is. But we see it over and over and over. Feather duster worms on the floor of the ocean curl with the Fibonacci spiral. The proboscis of a moth curls with the Fibonacci spiral. We've already talked about the spider web, the limbic structure of the human brain. There are structures inside Chlorotella algae that curl with the Fibonacci spiral. Do you know there's an outfit called the American Fibonacci Society that does nothing but look for Fibonacci spirals in nature? These are people with way too much time on their hands. They have printed over 500 books, over 6,000 color photographs of Fibonacci spirals in the natural world. And it goes on and on. The DNA helix is curled with a Fibonacci spiral. The cochlea of the inner ear is curled with a Fibonacci spiral. The umbilical cord of a baby is curled with a Fibonacci spiral. There are thousands of them. And there is no reason. But let's step out science, outside of science here, and let's talk about something else. One of the lessons I did not get a chance to present here this week, which is in my mind one of the most important lessons in our series, is what is God and how are we created in His image? What I'm really after in that discussion is what is a soul and how do you know you got one? But one of the properties we look at there is the aesthetic value of art and music. Why does man express himself in art? Why does man express himself in music? Do you ever hear of a chimpanzee writing a protest song? Why does man worship God? If chimpanzees are 99.6% as we are genome-wise, then why don't they do 99.6% of what we do? If everything is determined by our genetics. You see, that doesn't wash. And everybody that's worked in the field knows very well it doesn't wash. But there's another concept. You know, if you come to South Bend, Indiana, where I live, and if I take you on a tour of South Bend, there's some stuff you might like to see. For instance, one of the places that I like to take people is the corner of Ridgedale and York. Now, you know, we have Notre Dame, we have the Gold Dome, we have Old Baldy. No, don't get ahead of me here now. Old Baldy is a sand dune on Lake Michigan. It's the largest freshwater sand dune in the world. It's incredible. But that's just one thing to see. This is a house on the corner of Ridgedale and York in South Bend. The Hillmans live here. I had 9 of their children in my classes at Riley High School over the years. And I was a yearbook photographer, so I took a lot of pictures in this house. This house is incredible. You're looking at the north side there. The windows on the north side are little tiny windows. Very, very thick, made of a special kind of glass. On the other side, to the right, and you can't see it real well, we have a little light pollution here, but the windows are big, made of a different kind of glass. This house is so well engineered, so well designed by the architect, that even though we can hit 40 below in South Bend, this guy never has to turn on his furnace, never needs his air conditioning. It's incredible. And the architect is known for multiple roof lines, broken up structures. And after you oohed and awed for a while, I would say to you, well, this was a very famous architect. His name is Frank Lloyd Wright. Because I took pictures in this house and because I was involved with the people that lived there, I kind of got interested in Frank Lloyd Wright architecture. And I got pretty good at spotting it sometimes. One time I was in Tucson, and this is the front view of the house, and I went by this place. And I'm in a limo going to the airport, and I yelled at the limo driver. I said, "Stop, stop, I got to get a picture." I'm the only guy in the limo, so he stops. I got out, shot the picture, got back in. I'm going nuts, you know. Man, look at this. Big windows over here, little windows back there, multiple roof line. This looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright house. He said, "How'd you know that?" I said, "I recognize the design." About 3 weeks later, I was at the University of California, Berkeley. I went by this place. I'm in a cab this time. Yelled at the cab driver, "Stop, stop, 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 got to get a picture." Got out, shot the picture. I'm getting back in the cab. Man, look at this. Look at this. Multiple roof lines. Big windows here. Little windows on the other side. This looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright house. He said, how'd you know that? I said, I recognize the design. Talking about getting your foot in your mouth. About 3 weeks later, I'm in Lakeland, Florida. Walking on the campus. And I'm gushing. Man, look at this. You Florida people, you have no shame. You copy our northern architects and don't even give credit. He said, what do you mean we didn't give credit? Look over there. And here's a big sign that says this entire university was designed by the famous architect Frank Lloyd Wright. And I'm already saying, I'm sorry. See, I've gotten interested in Frank Lloyd Wright houses. And recently I got to visit Falls House in Pittsburgh. That's not far away, folks. Sometime you come south, jump across, and take a look at this. This is an incredible house. This thing straddles the spring. It heats with it in the winter. It cools with it in the summer. Every room is specially designed. It's now a national monument. You have to pay to get in, but you can go and look at it. It's incredible. I'm a human being. That means I'm created in the image of God. That means I worship. That means I create art. That means I create music. That means that I have a special makeup because I'm in God's image. And God's creative wisdom is not just seen in me, it's seen in the creation. It's seen in the world all around me. And so as we look at things in nature and as we see God's design in nature, sometimes there's no survival battle. There's nothing critical about it in terms of whether we say it may even inhibit my survival. Sometimes it's just there because it's beautiful. And this is true of every single person in this room. There are some of you that can look at a painting on the wall and say, Van Gogh or Picasso. There are some of you can listen to three notes of music and say, Beethoven. Or Garth Brooks. Every single person in this room has something that you're good at that has nothing to do with your survival. It may be needlepoint, it may be fishing, it may be boating, it may be, well, you name it. We see God's beauty in express throughout the creation. And so there's color in places where color is not necessary. You know, leaves don't have to be different color. The color you see in a leaf is because the chlorophyll was shut off. That's the only thing that happens. But what's left behind is a chemical matrix which is different for every kind of tree. That takes planting. That takes design. It wouldn't have to be that way. They could all be exactly the same. Everything you see in nature that is beautiful, from the color of a rock to the beauty we see looking at the sky, is a function of the fact that God has an appreciation for beauty and has created beauty all around us. We are in His image. You know, there are so many intuitive examples. We have a set of books now. We've had them around for a long time. They're called Dandy Designs. There's three volumes here. We now have five volumes. The last volume, by the way, is in color. Each of these books has over 100 examples like the one I've just shown you. I mean, folks, it isn't as though occasionally we see something in the creation that speaks of wisdom. The universe is full of design, full of purpose. It is difficult not to see the beauty and wisdom of God if you take a science class. For that matter, it's difficult to not see the beauty and the wisdom if you take a canoe trip with Steve May. Just don't camp on an island in the middle of a lake with a single pine tree. And for some of you who don't know what that's about, ask Steve. The universe is full of intuitive design. And you know, when you look at statements like this, you have to recognize the statement is bankrupt in terms of understanding the beauty of the world around us. And it's important to understand that when atheists make statements like this, the statements make no sense at all. What is interesting to me is that there are so many illustrations in nature where you have circumstances where even people who are expertise in certain areas of science recognize the beauty and the wisdom of design. In our bi-monthly, we have statements from Nobel Prize-winning scientists. We have over 50 of those we have done so far. And I was looking the other day as how many Nobel Prize scientists have written statements supporting atheism. You know the answer? Two that I can find. 130 on the other side. The wisdom and the beauty is all around us. And the Bible says this to us. The Bible speaks eloquently of this. Listen to Romans, the first chapter, beginning with verse 19. For that which can be known of God lies plain before our eyes. God himself has made it clear to us. For those things of God which the eye is unable to see, ever since the beginning of the world, have been clearly perceptible and understandable through the things he has made. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've talked about so far this afternoon. That's all we will talk about. The things he has made. Look at the evidence. Think. Go where the evidence leads. Everything in science supports the fact that we can see God through the things he has made. The more you know of the creation, the more you know of the Creator. But then it takes us a leap beyond. Even his eternal power and deity. The unbeliever then is without excuse. We can know there is a God. But then it describes our culture. But they have refused to honor him as God or to give thanks to him. Hence their thinking has ended in futility and their misguided minds are plunged in darkness. Behind a facade of wisdom, they have become just fools. Can you give me a better description of the world in which you live tonight? But what has happened in the last 10 years is that we have come up with another step in this process. It's called irreducible complexity. The author of this was Richard Behe to start with. He had a book which was called Darwin's Black Box. And what Behe said is, well, all of these scientific models and assumptions are wonderful. But are they mathematically feasible? You know, you can propose a solution to anything. What's interesting about the newspaper is that the newspaper's philosophy is, if you can imagine it, it's true. Now, just think about what I just said. If you can imagine it, it's true. So, for instance, right now we have a comet that has had a lander put on it. The newspapers are saying, oh, well, when we get the data from the comet, we'll be able to explain the creation of life. We'll be able to explain the creation of the earth. All of our questions will be answered. Oh, really? Where do you get that assumption? Not from the evidence. There are 12 different kinds of comets. This may turn out to be a cinder. And if it is, there won't be anything. Or maybe we'll be lucky and it'll have some water in it. Or maybe we'll be super lucky and it will have some amino acids in it. But that tells us nothing about the history. It just tells us where the raw materials were positioned. If I can imagine it, it must be true. Oh no, that's not science. And the question becomes, when you look at the reality of the world around us, and sometimes I do this by my own definition of irreducible complexity. This is simple, okay? Behe's the intellectual, I'm the dummy, okay? But when you look at the simple questions, then you can come up with stuff that we can all understand. And my favorite example is not to go into the physics, although I do this with college groups sometimes, but rather, instead of looking at all of the design characteristics that could be designed and could be answered, what I want to do is to ask you to think about a very simple question, which is called the anthropic principle. When you look at the creation as a whole, what are the odds that it could happen by chance? As we look at it from a human being. And let me phrase it this way. Let's assume the universe began with a big bang. Now, we won't worry about what banged or who banged it. Okay? The Big Bang has nothing to do with anything. It's not an explanation of creation. It's not an explanation of anything. It's just an observation, a guess. As a matter of fact, you know where the Big Bang came from? Frederick Hoyle was making fun of some of his fellow astronomers. And he said, "You guys, you believe in a Big Bang?" And they said, "Oh, that sounds pretty good. Yeah, we'll copy that." I'm serious. It came about as a joke from Frederick Hoyle. Research it. But let's just take it. Let's assume the universe began with a Big Bang. And let's ask this question. What are the mathematical odds that any kind, not ours necessarily, that any kind of life could come into existence by chance alone from the Big Bang? Now be careful, college students. This is not an ad hoc argument. I'm not saying we're here. What are the odds we got here? No, you can't do that. That's ad hoc. I'm saying let's assume that there's a Big Bang, and we're sitting there before the Big Bang, and we're saying, what are the odds that any kind of life could exist, could be come into existence on a workable planet by chance alone from this singularity? Now that we can do something about. Let me show you some of the parameters, some of the variables. You don't have to understand the variables. You will understand the conclusion, I promise you. You don't need to worry about the variables, but I want to show them to you. We live in a galaxy. Our galaxy is called the Milky Way. What's interesting is that our galaxy is not the only kind of galaxy that's out there. There are lots of kinds of galaxies out there, and our galaxy is just one of the many kinds. For instance, our galaxy, which is a spiral type B galaxy, is not very abundant. The most abundant kind of galaxy in space is an elliptical galaxy. But elliptical galaxies have no interstellar material. There is nothing to make a planet out of. There is nothing to make life out of. How can you have life in a place where there's nothing to make it out of and nothing to make the life out of, even if you had a place? And by the way, when I say elliptical, I'm including dwarf elliptical for those of you that are astronomers. They look like this, and they are totally devoid of interstellar material. The same kind of thing is true of irregular galaxies. A similar type of problem occurs with Seyfert galaxies that just blow up every so often. Of all of the different kinds of galaxies in space, only about four out of every 100 could possibly have a life support system on it, because they don't have the materials necessary to make life. So if it's 4 out of 100, what are the odds? 1 in 25. Okay, file it away. We'll be right back. Let's talk about how they look. You see pictures like this and the galaxies all look different. Why do they look different? Well, there's two reasons. One reason is they are different. The other reason is that when you look at them, it determines what you see. Now, a classic example would be this book. If you look at this book like that, it looks a certain way. Okay? Now, that galaxy is looking at the galaxy from the top, just like you're doing this. But if I take it and I rotate it like this, it looks different, doesn't it? Okay? If you took the galaxy and you rotated the galaxy, it would look like this. And what we have learned, thanks to the Hubble telescope, is where you are in the galaxy makes a difference. We didn't know that until Hubble. There have been over 100 major discoveries from Hubble. Every one of them supports the biblical record. Every one of them. And this is an example. So the green areas are places where we now know there's too much gravity for a stable solar system to exist. The red areas are areas where there's too much activity for a stable solar system to exist. Only within the dotted lines, which are called axial gravity lines, could you have a stable solar system. So what we have are two donuts, one on the top, one on the bottom, that could possibly have a life-supporting solar system in it. What are the odds of being in one of those donuts? Well, that's a high school geometry problem. You divide the volume of the donuts by the volume of the whole galaxy. That's easy. Volume of the donuts is 12 cubic light years. The volume of the whole galaxy is 15,750,000 cubic light years. You could easily talk 12 out of 15,750,000. Okay, let's go on. The sun. The sun is an incredible furnace made of its own fuel. I hope you saw the eclipses in October. You got some unique views of this incredible furnace that we have. But what you may not know is the sun is an exceptional star. When I was in school, they said it was an average star. It's not average at all. We now know that many stars in space are much different than the sun. The Hubble telescope has told us that there are blue hot stars that are microwave emitters. It would cook anything that got anywhere near it. Could never be any kind of organic material in a place around a blue star. The Hubble telescope has shown us that not only do we have the blue stars, this is the Pleiades, by the way. If you want to see that picture, get a pair of binoculars, go out and look at it. It's rising in the east right now. It's gorgeous. You have incredible skies sometimes, once in a while, occasionally. But if you look at the Orion constellation, you'll see a lot of redness. And the Hubble telescope has told us now that 70% of every star it has looked at is a red dwarf. Well, isn't that interesting? 70% is too small to support a functional solar system. And by the way, you can't just get closer to them because you're inside Roush's limit and it would fall apart. 10% white dwarfs. 15% K dwarfs. That means 95% of the stars that the Hubble telescope has analyzed are too small to support a functional solar system. Now, you hear the papers talking about, oh, we found 7,000 exoplanets. That's planets orbiting other stars. So there's got to be life out there. Hey, newspaper guy, do you ever think of asking what the stars look like? You're not going to have life even if you got planets around something that's too hot to support it or too small to support it. So our sun is special. Some of the stars are too big. This is Betelgeuse and Orion. I always laugh when I look at this because the screens I'm on are always too small to show it. That's Betelgeuse to the left, the one I just showed you. Compared to Betelgeuse, that's the sun right there. You say, I can't see it. That's right. It's so small, it won't show up on that screen. It's too small to show. Isn't that incredible? Our sun is so small, it's unreal in comparison with things. If the sun became a red giant, it would look like the background. The earth would look like the foreground. There'd be no life here. So our sun is incredibly small. Many stars flare. They're not very polite. They belch every so often. Our sun is very polite. It doesn't belch. It doesn't burp. It's very consistent. Some stars explode. Our sun doesn't do that. Look at the shockwaves from supernova 1987A. And we now know that 90% of the stars in the sky are not single stars. They're two or more stars orbiting each other. Now, you don't have to have a PhD in astronomy to tell me what's going to happen if the Earth is orbiting either one or both of those stars. Watch a kid cook a marshmallow on a campfire, and you got an idea. Our kids do a lab in high school. It's called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. What they do is they plot the temperature of stars against the luminosity. Luminosity on the vertical axis. There are 20 million different possible data points on that graph, and only one that would allow a life-bearing carbon-based, water-based planet to exist. And if you want to talk about fire people and rock people, we can do that. But the point is, the sun is incredible. Very different. And some stars are black holes. Black holes. Space-going vacuum cleaners that suck up anything that comes anywhere near them. If a black hole came near the sun, it would rip it apart instantly. If a black hole came near a terrestrial body like the Earth, it would destroy it in a literal flash. Now, you've seen imaginative movies about black holes, but these are real objects. And we're very fortunate. There's lots of things you can worry about when you leave here tonight. But being swallowed by a black hole is not one of them. The closest black hole to us is in the Northern Cross. It's called Cygnus X1 Beta. It is 4,700 light years from the Earth. and poses no threat to us whatsoever. But what are the odds of being in a part of space with no black holes that warp the region of space around them? We have discovered over 300 of them in the last year. So it is incredibly rare. And here is the first actual photograph of a black hole. It's digital, as you can tell. The black hole is right here. This is a star being ripped apart, like we just described, and spiraling into the black hole. For those of you with a background in science, what's fascinating here is the distance across here is the same distance that we are from the sun, the orbit of the Earth, and it makes that journey in 12 hours. It takes us 365 days. Why? Because of the black hole having such a huge mass. So we have not only wonderful janitors cleaning up space, cleaning out the debris, but we have been placed in an area where that doesn't happen. We can go on here for hours. I teach astronomy. I love this stuff. There's so many wonderful examples of God's wisdom and planning and how he's done things. How far you are from the sun makes a difference. The only thing wrong with Venus is it's too close to the sun, but that screws up everything else. We could talk about being too far from the sun, obviously too cold. We can talk about the size of the planets. If you're too big, you have the wrong gases. If you're too small, you have no gases. And do you remember what happened in 1996? Some of you old-timers will. Some of you young people won't know about this. In 1996, we had a comet that was going to hit the Earth. It was called the Levy-Shoemaker Comet. That's not it. That's Hale Bopp. Hale Bopp, nice pictures. Levy-Shoemaker, didn't look too good. For a very interesting reason. In order for the comet to get to us, it had to come in from outside the solar system. Astronomers knew it was going to hit the Earth. The trajectory was perfect. But they didn't know anything about what it would do. They were afraid it might even destroy the Earth. There was panic in some quarters. You old-timers, remember what happened? As a comet came into the Earth, it had to go by Jupiter. As it came by Jupiter, Jupiter ripped it up into 17 pieces. And in July of 1996, you sat in your living room, if you're my age, and you watched those pieces slam into the surface of Jupiter, producing a fireball larger than the diameter of the Earth. If that thing had hit the Earth, it would have destroyed 95% of everything on this planet. But you know what we've learned since that time? And this is absolutely incredible. The Hubble telescope has now shown us it is a statistical impossibility for a comet to hit the Earth. Because we have four comet sweepers: Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, and Jupiter. Those four planets are just the right size and in just the right place to intercept anything coming from the Oort cloud, which is where comets come from. If they were bigger or smaller, they wouldn't work. If they were in any other orbit, they wouldn't work. What are the odds of being four different planets in exactly the right position to prevent the calamity that we have seen now over and over on Jupiter? The last time this happened was 2 months ago. We saw it happen again. This is pretty regular. And by the way, for those of you with a background in science, the reason the comets come in along the ecliptic is because of the alignment. The gravitational field pulls them into a planar orbit. And if you're thinking about asteroids, they're inside Jupiter's orbit. That's a different animal. And they have a different purpose. Well, as I said, we can go on and on. A magnetic field, critical to our survival. And it's important to see how the survival of life on this Earth has been dependent upon the magnetic field. The tilt of the Earth, critical for mixing our atmosphere. Important for regulating temperatures. Do you know what it takes to move that polar vortex out that happened, that made our snow and cold right now? You know how much of an effect that is? 0.0001% change in the insolation, the total energy coming into the Earth from space. That's how sensitive it is. And you know what controls that? The moon. The moon stabilizes the Earth's tilt. This again is a new discovery from the Hubble telescope. It keeps the Earth's tilt at 23.5 degrees, which mixes our atmosphere and avoids polar vortexes from moving repeatedly south. You know, why they're moving now is probably related to some of the imbalances in the heat on the Earth. But what's interesting about that is there are books written down on this, an excellent book called What If the Moon Didn't Exist, written by the head of the astronomy department at the University of Maine, shows that if we didn't have a moon, if you took it away right now, life would cease to exist within 10 years. By the way, we still have some bibliographies over there. If you're interested, get the book and read it. It's in your library. What are the odds of having a moon with the right size that can control the tilt? We could even talk about the distribution of the atmosphere. 26 different layers to our atmosphere. And you've heard of some of them. You know, the ozone layer, that's the one your deodorant's tearing up. They're all important. But let's put some numbers on this. What I like to do is to pick 10 variables. Now, I could pick 100 variables. On the table over there, there's a chart with 47 variables I won't use. I'm just going to choose 10. 10 that we've mentioned. And what I'm doing here is that I'm giving an odds way below what we talked about. Like we said, the odds of being in the right place in the galaxy was 12 out of 15,750,000, but I'm going to use 1 in 100. We said the odds of having the right star is probably 1 in 20 million. I'm going to use 1 in 25. The odds of right distance, Bode's law. The right mass, right spin, right tilt. Having no black holes, comet sweepers. Now you look at those numbers and you say, yeah. I take those kind of chances every time I get on the QEW. No argument. No argument. Well, let's have a little lesson in probability here, which may or may not be needed. I think I'm loud enough you can hear me without that for a minute. Got a deck of playing cards. 52 cards in the deck. There's an extra space in the deck. Got a professor camera sitting here in the first row. I'm going to ask the professor, man, take a card, hit the card, hit the card. What are the odds you draw that ace of spades? Why is the gamblers in the audience? Okay, take a shot. What are we good to do? You're right. You draw the card. All right. Then hearts. No. I want the ace. It has an A on it. It has a shuffle.
Probabilities. 1 out of 52 times 1 out of 52. That's one chance out of 2,700 people, right? Okay. Let me show you how fast that goes up. Suppose I say, hey, this guy's so handsome. This time, he's going to go to the ace of spades 4 times in a row. I hold out the deck, he pulls the ace of spades. I put it back in, he draws it again. I put it back in, he draws it again. I put it back in, he draws it again. 4 times in a row on the cold deck. He's got to be cheating. What are the odds? 1 out of 52 times 1 out of 52 times 1 out of 52 times 1 out of 52. That's one chance out of 7,316,111. Don't believe me, try it. Right now. You say, all right, big deal. You know, I'm not running a casino. What's the point of all this?
The point of all this is what we have up there. It doesn't do any good to be in the right kind of galaxy if you're in the wrong place in the galaxy. It doesn't do any good to be in the right kind of galaxy, in the right place in the galaxy, if you're going around the wrong kind of star. It doesn't do any good to be the right kind, right place, right kind of star. If you're sitting right on top of that star, you're going to burn, baby, burn! And if you're too far away, you're going to freeze. In other words, everything up there is essential. So what do you have to do with those numbers? Multiply, right. You have to multiply this times 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 this. And if you do that, what you will get is one chance out of 7,5,7,8,1,2,5,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0,0, Okay. If that's your religion, which it is, a religion, okay. But you have to go where the evidence leads you. Does that make sense? You know, if you jump out of an airplane 10,000 feet in the air with no parachute of any kind, the odds of your survival are 1 in 10 million, according to the North American Parachute Company. Now, if I had a billfold here with $1 million in it, yeah. If I had a billfold here with $1 million in it, and I say to you, I will give it to you tax-free. If you jump out of an airplane 10,000 feet over Toronto with nothing on but your birthday suit, who'd be first? You got to volunteer. Is preacher school that bad? You know, I gave this lecture at the University of California, Berkeley, not too long ago, and I was really afraid to use this illustration. But even at Berkeley, nobody raised their hand. No human being in possession of the faculties will gamble their life on odds of 1 in 10 million. And that was everybody in this audience with one notable exception. If you wouldn't gamble your life on 1 in 10 million, why would you gamble your eternal soul on a probability that is 176 million times worse than that? Folks, it is mathematically impossible to be an atheist. This is what Anthony Flew saw. This is what he saw. He saw that the probabilities were utterly ridiculous. They were beyond any direct limit of probability acceptance. And I think it's important to understand, we only talked about having the right place. Now, let's go on and talk about having life by chance. Well, we don't have time. But the important thing to understand is that number is even worse. And even then, you've only got the right ingredients. I come back to my original statement. It is impossible for science and the Bible to conflict, because God created and God gave us His Word. And this week we have talked about evidence. But let me tell you something. I've listened to as many presentations as I could get to. I could only be in one place at a time. But everything I've heard everybody say has said the same thing. We've only scratched the surface of the evidence. I've got 32 basic lessons in my presentations, and I only gave, actually, two of them. The others were special things for here. The evidence is so powerful that we need to understand that we can know there is a God through the things He has made. We need to be proud. We need to be understanding. We don't need to be apologetic. We don't need to be ashamed. We can know there is a God and live confidently following His Word. And say to kids, you don't believe just because I believe. You believe because you look at the evidence and realize that the God who created you knows what is best for you and has given us a mountain of evidence so we can be confident about our faith. Would you bow with me in closing prayer? Father, thank you for minds that can think. Thank you for those who have planned this wonderful time that we've had together to be with one another, to study your word, to study your creation. to talk about the ways we can more effectively serve you. We're thankful for the many wonderful programs going on for those who are serving you so well here in Ontario and throughout Canada. And Father, we thank you for the creation. Not only for the wisdom you display in it that we can see and understand, but also for the incredible beauty that you place all around us. And especially the beauty of love. The beauty of having brothers and sisters who we can share with and be joyful to be around and be confident to be around and trust. We are so thankful, Father, that you have given us the church and all of the beauty that it brings into our lives. We ask you to dismiss us now, Father, in your loving care. Give everybody here safety in getting home. And help us leave here with a renewed determination to serve you better. And to radiate the confidence that we know the apostles had. Because we know our relationship to you. We know our destiny. And we know that you have given us the opportunity to teach and baptize all nations. Thank you, God, and dismiss us now. In God, I pray in Christ's name. Amen.